From Airwolf, Magnum PI, and Saint Elsewhere, Native Voices and Days of Our Lives, this is Jean Bruce Scott congratulating you on your excellent taste for choosing this station and podcast.
Jenny Finch, author, creator of The Drowners and Death of the Elver Man, and general Renaissance woman, your host for the Book of the Month.
This month's book is Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy. Red Storm Rising is Tom Clancy's second novel, following his best-selling debut, The Hunt for Red October. Written in 1986, towards the end of the Cold War, it covers events leading up to and during a war between the Soviet Union and NATO. The book opens, somewhat prophetically, with an attack on the main Soviet oil refineries by Muslim terrorists, leaving the country critically short of fuel. The Politburo launches an attack in an attempt to seize control of the Persian Gulf, triggering World War III. The book has a rather unusual style. Following a conventional opening narrative, the story is told in short sections, jumping from one location and set of characters to another. This in some way reflects the reality of life for those engaged in modern warfare. Your vision is limited to the enemy before you, and it's almost impossible to build a complete picture of events despite all our modern communications. Each theatre of war has its own focus, reflecting both sides of the conflict, which allows Clancy to make political as well as military observations throughout.
Kiev, the Ukraine. Captain Ivan Mikhailovich Sergatov reporting as ordered, Comrade General. Be seated, Comrade Captain. The resemblance to his father was remarkable, Alexeyev thought. Short and stocky, the same proud eyes, the same intelligence. Another young man on his way up. Your father tells me that you are an honor student in Middle East languages. That is correct, Comrade General. Have you also studied the people who speak them? That is an integral part of the curriculum, Comrade, the younger Sergatov smiled. We've even had to read through the Koran. It is the only book most of them have ever read, and therefore an important factor in understanding the savages. You do not like the Arabs, then? Not particularly. But our country must do business with them. I get along with them well enough. My class will occasionally meet with diplomats from politically acceptable countries to practice our language skills. Mainly Libya, and occasionally people from Yemen and Syria. You have 3 years in tanks. Can we defeat the Arabs in battle? The Israelis have done so with ease, and they don't have a fraction of our resources. The Arab soldier is an illiterate peasant, poorly trained and led by incompetent officers. A young man with all the answers. And perhaps you will explain Afghanistan to me, Alexeyev thought. Comrade Captain, you will be attached to my personal staff for the forthcoming operation against the Persian Gulf states. I will lean on you for linguistic work and to support our intelligence estimates. I understand that you are training to be a diplomat. That is useful to me. I always like to have a second opinion of the intelligence data that KGB and GRU send us. Not that I distrust our comrades in the intelligence arms, you understand. I simply like to have someone who thinks army to review the data. The fact that you've served in tanks is doubly valuable to me. One more question. How are the reservists reacting to the mobilization? With enthusiasm, of course, the captain replied. Ivan Mikhailovich, I presume your father told you about me. I listen attentively to the words of our party, but soldiers preparing for battle need to know the unvarnished truth so that we can bring about the party's wishes. Captain Sergatov noted how carefully that had been phrased. Our people are angry, Comrade General. They are enraged over that incident in the Kremlin, the murder of the children. I think enthusiasm is not a great exaggeration. And you, Ivan Mikhailovich? Comrade General, My father told me that you would ask this question. He told me to assure you that he had no prior knowledge of it, and that the important thing is to safeguard our country so that similar tragedies will never again be necessary. Alexeyev did not reply at once. He was chilled by the knowledge that Sergeyev had read his mind 3 days before, and dumbfounded that he had confided so enormous a secret to his son. But it was good to know that he had not misread the Politburo man. He was a man to be trusted. Perhaps his son also? Mikhail Eduardovich evidently thought so. Comrade Captain, these are things to be forgotten. We have enough to occupy us already. You will work down the hall in room 22. There is work waiting for you. Dismissed.
This style of writing can be difficult for the reader, with sudden jumps from events and countries, sometimes reflecting and reacting to the previous segment, but occasionally seemingly completely disconnected. In some ways, this is a result of how the book was created, as Clancy used a war game to model much of the action. There is also an exceptional, some might say excessive, level of technical detail in the novel, with each submarine, ship, aircraft, tank, and even missile being named and described before being placed into the story. On occasions, this can interrupt the flow of the narrative, and there is a sense Clancy is demonstrating his expertise and insider knowledge for the benefit of someone other than the reader.
USS Faris. All ahead, one-third, the executive officer ordered. All ahead, one-third, aye. The quartermaster of the watch responded, moving the annunciator handle up from the ahead full setting. A moment later, the inside pointer changed also. Engine room answers, all ahead, one-third. Very well. Faris slowed, coming off a 25-knot sprint to commence another drift manoeuvre, and allowing her towed array sonar to listen for hostile submarines. Morris was in his bridge chair, going over messages from shore. He rubbed his eyes and lit up another Pall Mall. "Bridge!" called the urgent voice of a lookout. "Periscope feather on the port bow! Halfway to the horizon! Port bow!" Morris snatched his binoculars from the holder and had them to his eyes in an instant. He didn't see anything. "Battle stations!" ordered the XO. The alarm gong went off a second later, and weary men ran again to their posts. Morris looped his binoculars around his neck and ran down the ladder to his battle station in CIC. The sonar loosed a dozen ranging pings to port as Morris took his position in CIC. Nothing. The helo lifted off as the frigate manoeuvred north, allowing her towed array sonar to track on the possible contact. Passive sonar contact? Evaluate as possible submarine bearing 013, announced the towed array operator. Steam noises? Sounds like a possible nuke. I got nothing there, said the active sonar operator. Morris and his ASW officer examined the water conditions board. There was a layer at 200 feet. The passive sonar was below it and could well be hearing a submarine that the active pings could not reach. The lookout might have seen anything from a spouting whale, this was the mating season for humpbacks, to a streak of foam, or the feathery wake left by a periscope. If it was a submarine, he had plenty of time to duck under the layer. The target was too close to be bottom-bounced and too far for the sonar to blast directly through the layer. Less than 2 miles, ASW said. More than two. If this is a sub, we're up against a good one. Great. Get the helo on him right now, Morris examined the plot. The submarine could have heard his frigate as it sprinted at 25 knots. Now, at reduced speed and with Prairie Musker operating, Faris would be very hard to detect. So the sub's fire control solution had probably just gone out the window. But Morris didn't have one either, and the submarine was perilously close. An urgent contact report was radioed to the screen commander 20 miles away. The sea sprite dropped a pattern of sonoboys. Minutes passed. I got a weak signal on number 6 and a medium on number 4, the sonoboy petty officer said. Morris watched the plot. That made the contact less than 3 miles off. "Drop some pingers," he ordered. Behind him, the ship's weapons officer ordered the arming of the Azrak and torpedo launchers. 3 miles off, the helicopter turned and swept across the target area, dropping 3 CAS buoys this time, which sent out active, non-directional pings. "Contact! A strong contact on buoy 9! Classify as possible submarine. I got him. Bearing 015. This one's a sub. Classify as positive submarine contact," said the towed array man. "He just increased power. Some cavitation sounds. Single screw submarine. Maybe a Victor class. Bearing changing rapidly left to right." The active sonar still didn't have him despite continuous maximum power pings down the correct line of bearing. The submarine was definitely under the layer. Morris wanted to manoeuvre but decided against it. A radical turn would cause his towed array sonar to curve, rendering it useless for several minutes. Then he would have to depend on sonar boys alone. And Morris trusted his towed sonar more than the boys.
Unlike his novels featuring Jack Ryan, there is no central character in Red Storm Rising. Instead, the reader follows the paths of a number of men, principally an American Navy weatherman in Iceland and a Russian general in Germany, with a wider range of secondary characters offering different viewpoints on events. This, along with the extraordinary range of the story, may be the reason that, unlike Clancy's more conventional books, including The Hunt for Red October, Patriot Games, and Clear and Present Danger, no one has yet attempted to turn it into a film. Global events caught up with Red Storm Rising shortly after publication, with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the subsequent demise of the Soviet Union. For a number of years, some of his books read as historical fiction, the what-ifs of a bygone age. The current world situation would suggest events such as those depicted in Red Storm Rising might just possibly still occur, giving the novel a new lease of life and the disturbing contemporary spin. Red Storm Rising shows Clancy's keen eye for global events at its best, and the book certainly bears rereading. As a depiction of global conflict, it is excellent, and it is a rare achievement to combine such a level of detail with the very human sense of what war means to those caught up in it.
Parkville is a purpose-built residential care centre situated at the heart of Middlesbrough and providing personalised care in a modern and homely environment. Parkville aims to help older people to continue to live independent and active lives within the wider community, whilst benefiting from the care and support of an experienced and dedicated team of nursing and care staff. At Parkville, we provide facilities to accommodate elderly residential and nursing service users. To find out more, please telephone 01642 223334 or visit our website at parkvillecarecentre.com. Parkville Care Centre. Care to call us home.
In today's crowded world, it's sometimes hard to get heard. And sometimes you need a little extra push to be heard. That's where Manila PR can help. We specialise in online radio and press for independent bands, with prices to match, and have been doing so for the last decade. So if you have a noise to make, make it with Manila. Visit manilapr.com now.
Here are some handy tips and information regarding your hospital bedside TV, radio and phone service. TV channels 1 to 5 are free to use at certain times every day, so check your screen for details. To help you keep in touch with friends and loved ones, outgoing calls are also free all day, every day, to landline numbers that begin with 01, 02 or 03. Radio channels can be listened to absolutely free at any time of day. If you would like to access a paid service, such as our wide range of TV channels, Sky Sports, our great range of films, or just need a little internet access, then you'll need to buy a bundle. Buying a longer stay bundle would give you the best value for money, so try to buy a bundle to suit your maximum length of stay. If you pay for a TV service with your debit or credit card and happen to leave the hospital earlier than expected, then just contact our customer care team from your bedside phone. They may be able to downgrade your bundle to a shorter duration and give you a partial refund. To find out more about bedside entertainment services and find a bundle to suit your needs, just pick up the bedside phone and speak to the friendly Hospedia customer care team. They'll help you find the best deal. And remember, to contact Hospital Radio, just pick up the phone and dial star 800.
Offering prestigious accommodation, ensuite facilities and high-quality care for residents provided 24/7 by qualifying nurses and carers, Roseville Care Centre provides the perfect home for its residents' emotional, spiritual, social, physical and intellectual needs. A purpose-built residential care facility in the heart of Ingleby Barwick, Roseville is a care centre which provides facilities to accommodate elderly residential and nursing service users, offering both short and long stay accommodation, as well as respite and daycare. To find out more, please telephone 01642 308188 88 or visit our website rosevillecarecentre.com. Roseville Care Centre.
From Airwolf, Magnum PI, and St. Elsewhere, Native Voices and Days of Our Lives, this is Jean Bruce Scott congratulating you on your excellent taste for choosing this station and podcast.
Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy, a wonderful way of rolling R's as well. Jenny, a superb critique as ever there. We're joined in the studio by Heather Errington.
The role there.
Exactly. That? Welcome back.
Any Heather. Opportunity.
You had a chance to actually read Red Storm Rising, and from your own, actually, you didn't manage to get to read through Red Storm Rising, but from what Jenny's actually just described it as, do you think it's one which would appeal to you?
I probably wouldn't pick it up if it was on the shelf. However, I think I would give it a read maybe if I was on holiday and I had a lot of time to read and it was my second choice. Probably not.
It is a, it's not a bonk buster by any means, but of the 80s, there was a period of time, Jenny, probably to do with the advent of the word processor, where substantial 800-page novels became very much de rigueur. This was just his second novel, as you said at the start of the whole piece, and it was co-written, of course.
It was, yes. It was co-written with somebody who'd actually written the war game that he based The Hunt for Red October on as well.
And as we said, that war game aspect comes across. There is a resonance for those of us who remember the 80s about Ronald Reagan, Star Wars, and the whole essence that comes through with that. And it's really that whole notion that in every conceivable way, the possibilities of thermonuclear conflict were kind of being considered, and it was a case of brinkmanship was being played between Brezhnev and the Soviet Union, and obviously Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and others on the Western side of the NATO alliance. And this is one of those areas which I think has that as you said, as the underlying system. But if we're kind of digging deep into the whole system, wasn't it sad that Clancy seemed to be not necessarily misogynistic, but women characters are very few and far between? There are three that I can recall that really sort of emerged. One, of course, being the Icelandic 20-year-old woman who is a kind of romantic incident interest after being saved and having been raped by the invading Russians and so on, by one of the characters who I did feel was quite nice. That was Edwards. He sort of was well-rounded and well sorted through with that. The other female character, of course, being the fighter pilot, who goes to or shoots down satellites in a way which I think probably stretches credibility a wee bit, but she manages to cope. Almost a sort of alien Ripley-esque kind of character there from that perspective. And then I think we get the wife of character Morris, I think it's Morris, who goes on to lead up the USS Edward Ferris. Lots of characters there. I would have actually asked, really, Tom, if he'd been around today, it would have been nice to have actually had a character list at the start, so you could actually tick off the characters as they go through, because there are so many of them that are around. I think it would have actually helped, particularly given the level of technical techno-fetishization and indeed techno-babble
to use the phrase, that he uses with respect to his descriptions. And we heard, obviously, one of them, the selection we chose to read from in terms of the submarine scenario, where up to a point, I don't know whether what he was describing was complete fabrication or whether it was grounded in real harsh reality. I'm giving the benefit of the doubt to the author and saying it may well have been grounded in you know, experience and so on. It did carry with it resonances of a lot of the movies like Crimson Tide, clearly Clancy's very own Hunt for Red October. There were elements that were coming through with that. But also, there were science fiction elements as well that were in that that line of things, not just alternate histories, but I think you could easily substitute Alexeyev for Worf in Star Trek and have a Klingon as opposed to a Russian, and their sense of honour was actually there. I mean, it wasn't an anti-Russian piece at all. If anything, it was an anti-communist propaganda piece, but it was an the sense that we were faced collectively in the West with a Russian organization or a Soviet organization that kind of wanted to make one last expansionist move, and all sorts of other aspects were coming across within that. Less said the better about his portrayal of the British and indeed other European routines. And again, it did fall into the American trap, I suspect, of, well, thank heavens that the Americans are so successful at doing what they do, because they just do wonderfully well. Those are all the negatives, and I mentioned obviously the technobabble from that side of things. What were the other positives, Jenny? I mean, you alluded to some of them. Did you feel that there isn't a Jack Ryan? It's not a Jack Ryan novel, because he doesn't appear from that. Would it have benefited from actually having a character like Morris or Alexeyev more as a centralised character, or did you feel actually kind of the portfolio of characters provided it with a different panoramic viewpoint?
I think because of the scope of it, not only geographically, but because he tried to cover all the military services simultaneously, I think he had to have a portfolio of characters. I would have liked more on the two main characters. I would have liked a better sense of that. And we have nothing on the background of Alexeyev, for example. We don't know if he's married. We don't know what he's done in the past. We know very little about him. And we do have puppet bureaucracies on both sides. Mm. Although he makes political points, they're very, very cheap political points in a lot of ways. Russians bad, mindless, Americans responding but saving the world. That's about the limit of it. As you say, it's the Europeans who fight the Russians to a halt, which would happen if there was an invasion. But it's the Americans that save the world. And sometimes you look at it and you sigh wearily and go, again?
Well, it's easier than building a wall around yourself, I suppose. But still.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a sort of area which we won't go
into. That might work.
Not. I was surprised that we didn't have a great deal of follow-up from the original Muslim terrorist attack. I mean, I did feel that there was a whole area there that could have been explored. And yet the rest of the 800 pages, or 700-odd pages, that actually were there, focused very much on Iceland, the waters around Iceland and Europe, and the battle across Germany and the onset from obviously the former East Germany into West Germany and so on. And that was very much the theatre. The rest of the area was left very much, you know, to, well, it's just happening really, or not as the case may be. So global conflict triggering World War III. There are those of us who actually say we've been in World War III for a considerable period of time in an Orwellian sense. Heather, you weren't even born when the Berlin Wall effectively came down in 1989, so it is as far back in history as Pearl Harbor would be to myself. Special plug, we're producing a special podcast on Pearl Harbor with Morton Publications shortly, so here we are. It's a companion piece with one of my former students, Jack Harrison, who's also just produced a piece celebrating 90 years of Queen Elizabeth, her 90th birthday. Sorry, I'm getting into a Tom Clancy sort of scenario there. But Heather, what does it mean to your good self? I mean, looking back as a historical fact, because you would not recall Germany as being anything other than a united country. The notion of East Germany and West Germany and a balance there. And obviously, NATO still exists from that point of view, but the Soviet bloc of countries, the Warsaw Pact countries. What does it mean to you in 2016?
Germany itself?
Or that kind of description of the war, of the world being split up into that very, very classic binary opposition.
I don't
between
know.
Between the West and the Americans, the good guys, and the communists and the Russians and the Soviet bloc, the bad guys.
I think in 2016 you've just got to be very careful what you say in regards to any of that. You can't, you know, your opinion... I think sometimes now, just keep your opinion to yourself. As harsh as that may sound. Germany, obviously, I've never been to Germany. But in this regard, obviously, like you said, it's... When was it? 19? What did we say?
Well, the book is set in 1986, I think. Yes. That sort of ballpark area, then, exactly. It'd be interesting to see whether it actually had any influence on the fall of the Berlin Wall, because obviously it was making a cultural sort of aspect of that. You're shaking your head quite vociferously there, Jenny. So it's, but you know, that is some of the areas. I mean, one of the arguments that was put forward was actually it was the strength that was demonstrated by the then President Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in particular that effectively stood up to the evil empire, as it was referred to. And I just thought it's interesting in terms of the way in which we sort of position this now, because oftentimes it's been suggested, including, of course, the James Bond films, that actually lacking a kind of villain on that basis, and the kind of geopolitical situation we have in a contemporary sense, where it's kind of not sure, really. Is it the enemy within? Where are we going? It's obviously, it is a work of fiction, or possibly an alternative reality, and I think it stands on its own as a result of that. Jenny, you said computer game. I mean, I did get huge notions of a sort of Call of Duty-esque element coming across to this side of things, and indeed the company Red Storm Entertainment was founded as a direct sort of result of this, which Tom Clancy obviously works through. And would it be a game that you would enjoy playing?
Probably not. I don't play a lot of those types of games, although I do have a fondness for Cossacks. When I'm feeling really bad, I go away and kill things. Normally as the Russians, I have to say, because they have the best cavalry. I think... I can see people immersing themselves in this type of universe, and it falls into the category of what are called God games. It gives you a real sense of euphoria to move and slaughter thousands and thousands of individuals.
Which is probably my final kind of concern about the novel, insofar as if we talk about destruction porn that was recently put together in the first Superman movie, of course, Man of Steel, the revamped Superman movie, I should say, and is supposedly addressed in the upcoming Batman versus Superman epic as well. Although we kind of have a sort of sympathy with the characters, all of our kind of heroes and heroine, arguably, kind of they survive, they go through. There really isn't any sort of sense when I felt as though I really cared about them. And I suppose in terms of the characters, and others say, oh, well, you know, yay, success, we've just sunk a submarine with 200 lives, etc. There's one moment where I think it's the commander of the USS Faris who effectively has post-traumatic stress disorder, and the solution is to get drunk. Which
yes.
I thought, that's a bit trivial, really. You know, it's all right. And after that, he's all cured, effectively. He doesn't have the bad dreams. It's all sorted out. It's done and dusted. A little bit trivial, a little bit dangerous, perhaps, really, but... You know, again, perhaps, you know, very much on the level of playground cowboys and Indians, but with nuclear bombs as opposed to, well, of course, they're not used, but other weapons.
Maybe. Yes, they get close to that. I think it's very much of its time. And there is one point where one of the submarine commanders sinks an enemy submarine, and he says to himself, he tries not to think that there were men in that. Mm. And that's the only moment you have where you have anything apart from big flash in the sky, let's put a mark up on the wing, I've hit another one.
So, time for the scores. And the scores just from two people, because it is a prerequisite, Heather, sadly, that you do have to have read the book before you can really give it a mark. It's a tough call.
That's fair. That's only fair. Sorry.
I like to think so. Jenny?
I think I'd give it 6.5.
Because of the quality of the writing, and because of the and from both authors, and because of the technical aspect that was actually there, and because it worked through that, even though it could have used a bit of rigorous editing, which could have maybe reduced it, I think an awful lot of people might be put off by the sheer size and volume of 800 odd pages that Red Storm Rising entails. It never really stood a chance for me of getting into the sort of 9.5 to 10 region. Much so I would have liked to, but etc. But I think overall I'm going to go for 8. So in terms of the discussion, it's even dropped, because there was a time this morning I was almost going up to a 9, but reflecting on the whole system. So I still think Very good work. Be interested to see whether Rob Nichols ever gets around to reading it. I suspect not. He won't work through that. Yeah. So he's still there. And Heather, we would appreciate, obviously, your input from that point of view. If again, you sort of feel like having a good war novel to read in betwixt all the many other things that you actually do. Possibly, you'd like to take it on board from that basis. So next month, Jenny, what do we have?
Next month, we have, in homage, we will be looking at Harper Lee's wonderful To Kill a Mockingbird.
From Airwolf, Magnum PI, and Saint Elsewhere, Native Voices and Days of Our Lives, this is Jean Bruce Scott congratulating you on your excellent taste for choosing this station and podcast.